From NPR News, you're listening to the best of weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Guy Raz is away. This episode, we're looking at a very early case of clogged arteries in mummies. Then physicist Brian Greene on a new discovery that might turn the world of physics on its head. The little-known origin of the domestic hamster, plus beautiful and pointless modern poetry with David Orr and director Joe Wright on his new film, Hannah. And the soulful bilingual music of Guatemalan singer-songwriter Gabby Moreno. That is all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. $17 million people died of cardiovascular diseases last year alone, and that number is only expected to rise. Heart disease is supposed to be the result of the good living that modern life affords us, a diet rich in animal fat, too many hours spent on the sofa. But recent discoveries suggest that strokes and heart attacks may not just be the scourge of modern society. Joining us to explain is Dr. Greg Thomas. He is co-author of a paper in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology Imaging that describes heart disease among ancient Egyptians, specifically mummies. Dr. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, everything that I know about mummies, I learned in the National Geographic. But as I recall, mummies had all their innards emptied out and stored in canopic jars. So how did you do your research?
Well, it turns out there's not a canopic jar for the heart. They're for the abdominal organs. And so predominantly the heart was still there.
And so what did you do?
We did CT scanning at a scanner that had been donated actually by National Geographic, your teacher, to the Cairo Museum, their national museum, and imaged 52 mummies who had been or in their museum. And to our surprise, we found they did have vascular disease, atherosclerosis in many of their large arteries. And the small arteries of the body that cause events, for example, the arteries in the heart and the arteries to the brain, also had atherosclerosis.
Now that's a sort of a calcification.
Right. When we develop atherosclerosis or plaque or heart in the arteries, it starts with cholesterol and other cells, and then as it ages, it calcifies. So it kind of ossifies like a bone. So our hypothesis was that the calcium might still be there 3,000 years later to see if they indeed had these blockages.
So you had a lot of mummies to pick from, presumably. How'd you choose them?
We looked for older mummies. Mm-hmm. And we found, for example, a general. We thought, well, it took some time to be a general. You must be old. And so they were able actually to unscrew the glass case and look down in the sarcophagus and see someone been there for 3,000 years and then take them out of the sarcophagus and bring them over to scan. And it was just, you know, pinching myself to see how fortunate I was to look inside with the CT scanner and see what was going on.
One of the mummies that you scanned was a princess who had severe atherosclerosis. Now, presumably this woman was a locavore, ate fresh things. There was no refrigeration. She would not have been sedentary because she would have had no elevators. I mean, why would she get this kind of thing?
Well, our hypothesis was they wouldn't have them because they were active. Their diet was much different. They didn't have tobacco. But to our surprise, they had atherosclerosis in the large arteries as well as the small arteries that can cause problems. For example, in this woman who died 1550 BC, approximately, in her 40s, that she would have atherosclerosis, I think we're missing a risk factor. Right now, we know that high blood pressure, smoking, cholesterol, inactivity, and other things cause atherosclerosis, but I think that we're less complete than we think.
Now, obviously, working people did not merit mummification. Do you think that your research might be showing us a very inbred group, these aristocrats?
Well, the pharaohs and their families did like to keep the power and the wealth, so they would often, brothers and sisters, would be married. But we found the atherosclerosis over 2,000 years of time. And so there would be many different families who were the pharaohs or the ruling parties at the time. So it was, we think it's common to the environment there among the people who were the elite. So they did have access to meat. They actually had domesticated cattle, goats, antelope, gazelles, pigs. However, we think that predominantly their diet was grains, fruits, and vegetables and not near as much meat. We do hope in future expeditions to find mummies of the more common class, but we're suspicious that even the more middle-class persons that they may well have had it, but that's research to be done.
That's Dr. Gregory Thomas, a member of the team that discovered heart disease in Egyptian mummies. Dr. Thomas, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's been an exciting week for theoretical physicists. That's because researchers at the Fermi National Accelerator Lab in Illinois announced a suspicious bump in some data they've been collecting.
Yeah. It's been.
All right. We're here to talk about the bump. That's physicist Brian Green. He didn't find the bump, but like all physicists, he is excited about it because it might prove the existence of a new subatomic particle, and that would turn the physics world upside down. So, what is it?
Well, first of all, we don't know what it is. There are speculations about what the particle might be. One possibility is that it may be evidence of a new force of nature.
A new force of nature?
Yes.
Well, now, what could you possibly imagine a new force of nature would be?
Well, that is what makes it such an exciting time. We have spent many, many years investigating the known forces, and we understand them very well. So we understand why a child's magnet does what it does. We understand why light comes out of your light bulb. We even understand radioactive decay, and those nuclear forces are communicated by electromagnetic force, gravity. But this new force would suggest other processes that so far we've not yet seen and are very much at the very beginning of understanding what it would be capable of.
The problem with a potential new force of nature inside an atom, well, it's no accident we don't know what such forces, if they exist, might be.
Because they only operate over the shortest of distance scales, and that's why it takes a fantastically powerful machine to probe the universe over very, very short distances and see what new forces might be at work in the subatomic realm.
The powerful machine it takes to probe the subatomic realm is your basic subatomic particle supercollider. There are only a few in the world. Fermi Labs is scheduled to go dark this September due to budget cuts. Here's how it works.
Well, it's a 4-mile-long racetrack is what it is. It's a big, giant circle, and protons are sent racing around in one direction. Antiprotons are sent racing around in the opposite direction at incredibly high speeds. I mean, these particles go around this 4-mile-long racetrack 50,000 times each second. And every so often, they're directed into head-on collisions. And it's those head-on collisions that allow us to probe matter under the most extreme circumstances to try to reveal things that we couldn't find in everyday life.
Physicists do this, Brian Green says, by studying the rubble left behind after those collisions occur. That's where the next great discovery in physics could be hiding.
We can actually draw plots on a piece of paper which illustrate in a very precise way what kinds of debris should be created in these collisions. For many, many years, the data and the predictions agreed spot on. The curves matched precisely. But right now, they're finding that the two curves, the data versus the theory, don't match precisely. The data has a little tiny bump. But the reason why it's so exciting is for 25, 30 years, we've had a theory called the Standard Model. It's a mathematical theory that has been able to describe every single result from every experiment at any accelerator around the world for decades. To now see that perhaps it's not right. That may be what this bump is telling us, that there's something we don't understand, and that's kind of thrilling for us.
Physicist Brian Green. His latest book is The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos. He spoke to us from his office at Columbia University. Brian Green, thank you.
Sure, my pleasure.
In the spring of 1930, a biologist named Israel Aharoni ventured to the hills of Syria on a mission. He was searching for a rare golden mammal whose name roughly translates from Arabic as Mr. Saddlebags. It may all sound exotic, but the animal Aharoni discovered can now be found in many grade school classrooms and children's bedrooms, running on a wheel in a little cage. With me now to tell us more is Rob Dunn. He is a biologist and an assistant professor at North Carolina State University. He joins us from the studios at WUNC Chapel Hill. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to have a chance to talk with you today.
So how did you get on to Mr. Aharoni's story and his story of Mr. Saddlebags?
I'm fascinated with the stories of individual humans and the way they affect both the living world and our understanding of the living world. And my general sense is that more often than not, these big changes we see in the world often can be traced back to the actions of individual humans with all sorts of problems. And so I'm always on the lookout for these stories.
What inspired Aharoni to venture into the desert in search of this little saddlebag guy?
He was a Jewish scientist working in Jerusalem. And in general, he wanted to discover both known and unknown species in and around Jerusalem and to name them in Hebrew. But in this particular instance, he had a friend with whom he worked, Saul Adler. And Adler had been working with Chinese hamsters as a model organism to try to understand the disease leishmaniasis. But the hamsters wouldn't breed in the lab, and so every time he did an experiment and killed them, he would have to go get more Chinese hamsters or have them sent to him. Aharoni saw this as a chance both to discover this organism in the wild and to bring it back from Adler, who could then breed them and make major discoveries about humans.
What they ultimately had to do was dig a giant hole, and at the bottom of it, in a little burrow, they found a hamster nest, and took the little babies back to the lab. But as you describe it in your paper, he kept losing bits of this litter.
These rare animals that were going to be so hard to find, and he found in a farmer's field, and so he proceeded to dig this great deep 8-foot hole in the wheat field and pulled up 11 individuals originally, a mother and her babies. And immediately when they put them in a box, the mother started to eat one of the babies. And so one of the 11 was dead, and so they killed the mother. And so then there were 9, and so they brought the 9 back to the lab. And as hamsters are wont to do, 5 of them escaped from their wooden cage and ran somewhere in the lab and were never to be seen again. and so then there were 4. And the brother ate one of the sisters, and then there were 3.
Good At this Lord, point, this was a very brutal adventure.
I think it befits the Torah, at least sort of a Greek tragedy sort of story mixed with some Torah. And so they have these 3 individuals, and they very much want to breed them. And so, lo and behold, one of the sisters and the brother hamster have sex, and everyone is so excited that it's described as one of the greatest miracles in science of the times, that it's this incredible thing.
I guess those of us who've had some experience of modern hamsters would not think that this was so surprising.
It seems in retrospect to have been in the cards, I guess, or at least in the cedar shavings. but it's this amazing story. And so they reproduce, and they eventually produce 150 offspring, this sort of Adam and Eve hamster. And they start being taken abroad in people's coat pockets and official shipments to other places. And so the hamster that you might have had as a child descends from that original brother and sister, almost inevitably.
Why doesn't Israel Aharoni get the fame that he obviously deserves to be the father of the hamster, so to speak?
I suppose we don't think about the origin of hamsters as something that bestows ordinary fame. But I do think there are aspects of it that turn out to be quite significant to us as humans. And one of them is that the birth defects they tend to have lead to a kind of heart disease that's very similar to some human forms of heart disease. And so these hamsters have continued to be a good laboratory model precisely because they're so inbred, because of this original story involving Aharoni. And so they do matter to us in this unusual way, in addition to turning those wheels all around the world.
Rob Dunn is a biologist and an assistant professor of biology at North Carolina State University. Professor Dunn, thank you.
Thank you so much.
David Orr has written a new book, which he says is a guide to modern poetry. Beautiful and Pointless is the name of the book, and we assume a comment on modern poetry as well. David Orr was trained as a lawyer, but the trade he practices is poetry criticism. He writes for the New York Times Book Review. This book is a slender volume, like many of the books of modern poetry he critiques. It is tough going in places, requiring the reader to back up and try again. There are lots of funny bits and clever parenthetical observations, and there are lots of poems, good ones and bad ones, quoted to help us along. David Orr joins us from Cornell University. Welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you arrange your slender vol in six chapters, and the last is called Why Bother? But to proceed in order, the first is called The Personal. The second chapter is called The Political. I completely got the political, but the personal was harder. Could you just help me out here?
I think it really goes to the center of what a lot of people think about modern poetry, which is that it is expressive, that it is personal. And as you know, the chapter begins with an anecdote about me going to a party and being introduced to someone who asks what I do. And so, you know, I say, well, actually, you know, I'm a poetry critic. I review contemporary collections of poetry. And the smile just falls off of her face, and she says, "You mean you criticize people's poetry?" And it's, you know, it's a response that you get because people view poetry as being some sort of unfiltered expression of the poet's inner life. And so what I'm trying to do in that chapter is talk about that perception that I think a lot of general readers have and explain why it is in some sense mistaken, but it's also in a sense accurate. And then there's the persistence of just the romantic idea of poetry as emotion recollected in tranquility. It's actually never been, I mean, even when Wordsworth was talking about emotion being recollected in tranquility, he didn't mean, I'm just going to write down what I feel. He was suggesting that there's a lot of mediation that art does between the emotion that you feel and then the recollection in tranquility.
You also write about form and suggest that at one point you raise the question, that you think readers of modern poetry still really want answered, which is it still okay to like sonnets or what? So is it?
Right. I think that it is. I should say first, form is one of the things that poets like to argue about. And we have a lot of confusion about what we're talking about when we talk about form, and the confusion leads to these arguments about whether or not we should be writing in particular forms or whether a form has rules and things like that.
Or whether a form is dead or alive.
Exactly, exactly. And I think a poet's duty is just to be interesting. And one of the mechanisms that we use to be interesting is form. It could be a form like a sonnet. It could be a form like an erasure in which a poet is taking somebody else's text and just removing words from it. It could be form like meter.
You make the point that modern poetry, when it isn't a sonnet or some other rhymed form that we feel must certainly be a poem, that we can't always tell a poem from a bunch of broken lines or perhaps a little collection of prose. And I want to ask you to read a couple of examples. On page 70 is a part of the very beautiful poem, The Drowned Children.
Sure. You see, they have no judgment, so it is natural that they should drown, first the ice taking them in, and then, all winter, their wool scarves floating behind them as they sink, until at last they are quiet, and the pond lifts them in its manifold dark arms.
The poet is Louise Gluck. Now, why did you pick that one?
First I picked it because I like it. And it seemed like a nice way to put an example in of writing that isn't exactly formal, but that is also very good.
It isn't exactly formal in that it doesn't have a form. It doesn't
That's
rhyme.
Right.
It has no meter.
Right. It has what you might call a shape, but it doesn't have a separate form.
Now, mostly for meanness, I would like you to read Hart Seeley's offering called Happenings on page 72, and maybe you could explain what it is.
Okay. You're going to be told lots of things. You get told things every day that don't happen. It doesn't seem to bother people. It's printed in the press. The world thinks all these things happen. They never happened. All I can tell you is, it hasn't happened. It's going to happen.
Yes. Now, of course, I know what the joke is, so you tell us.
So all of the lines there are taken from a press conference of Donald Rumsfeld's in 2003. What's so funny about them, what's so great about that as a poem, as a parody, is that it sounds just like a kind of free verse modern poem.
Well, now, your last chapter, you called it Why Bother? So, David Orr, give us your best shot. Why bother?
Well, I don't know that people ought to bother. I think that poetry is one of those choices that you make in life that doesn't really, it's not really susceptible to reasoning or arguments. You know, people say things like, oh, poetry is the most distilled form of language. But, you know, you can actually think of a lot of other forms of language that are vastly more distilled. Or people will say poetry has this special relationship to people's inner lives, but then a lot of other things have special relationships to people's inner lives. None of those reasons are actually the reason that I read poetry. I read poetry because it's just one of the things that helps me to negotiate the world around me and helps me to understand my own feelings about things. And also, frankly, it's just something that entertains me. I think a better way to approach the question why bother is not really to answer it, but rather just to say that if you do bother, it can be worthwhile.
David Orr, his book on modern poetry is called Beautiful and Pointless. For an excerpt, you can check out our website, npr.org. David Orr, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hannah is a scary new thriller starring the young Irish actress Saoirse Ronan in the title role, together with a very strong supporting cast, including Cate Blanchett and Eric Bana. Hannah has been brought up in extreme isolation in the forests of Finland and trained by her father to be a killer. The movie was directed by Joe Wright, who's probably best known for the most recent version of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, not for the chases and fights you'll see in Hannah.
You know, the whole kind of action aspect of the movie was something that I thought would be interesting to explore, and I like working outside of my comfort zone.
In Pride and Prejudice, they occasionally walk into the village.
Sometimes they
engage in a bit of country dancing, but it's not the same thing. I mean, it's not even close.
No. Although, actually, I was so nervous of the action sequences that I just tried to pretend it was like the dance sequences in Pride and Prejudice and just, you know, fooled myself that way.
Your heroine, who is an incredibly beautiful young girl, Hannah, lives in a cottage in the woods, and it's all covered with snow. And as the movie goes on, the wicked stepmother shows up. You have lots of fairy tale elements in this movie. Was that part of the deal?
When I first read the script, the fairy tale elements weren't perhaps as explicit, but inherently in the structure, it was a kind of fairy tale. It's about a young person growing up in the safety of a family home who reaches an age where she needs to go and explore the world. So embarks on that journey and is confronted by evil for the first time and is required to overcome that evil, but at some cost.
Your character is a kind of a very sinister sleeping beauty, I would say. Her father tells her, she will try to kill you and she will never stop, and you have to be able to handle that. And of course, we don't know who she is, and we don't know why anyone would try to kill this angelic child. And then when she goes out into the world, people immediately start trying to kill her. Did you worry about the notion that a beautiful child who is incredibly murderous would be a heroine that the public would have a tough time with?
No, not really, because, I mean, you know, as you say, it's a fairy tale. It's not a depiction of a real child or a real world even. It is a fairy tale, and fairy tales, by their very nature, are violent and dark. I mean, the Little Mermaid, that's essentially a story of suicide. The mermaid kills herself at the end of The Little Mermaid, obviously not in the Disney colonized version. And in Hansel and Gretel, you know, two children take an old lady and put her in an oven. I think that fairy tales need to confront the dark side and overcome it.
You worked on music videos in the early days with the Chemical Brothers, the outfit that provided the score for Hannah. What made you think they would be the right sort of sound for this movie?
You know, having only worked with orchestral scores before, I kind of like the idea of blurring the division between music and sound effects, so that the sound effects kind of become the music and vice versa. And also because they work so extraordinarily with drum patterns, and they're the kind of best drum programmers around, really. And I felt that this film needed a kind of quite a pulsing rhythm.
I must say that Where I really noticed them was in that that container scene,
mm-hmm.
where Hannah is trying to escape from some people who are chasing her through a whole field of cargo containers. At some point, I realized that the noise was not so much people leaping from one to the other, but it was a drum score.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I like the idea of kind of disorientating the audience, and a lot of the film does that very kind of purposefully.
I understand that your next project will take you in another direction.
Uh-huh. We're hoping to make an adaptation of Anna Karenina.
Anna Karenina after this movie, I mean, this must be a bit of a swift 180 for you.
I love film, you know. I love all types of film in all genres. In fact, I kind of try to live and work outside of genre classification. I relish storytelling, really, and the chance film gives us to see the world from another person's point of view.
That's director Joe Wright. His new movie, Hannah, opens nationwide this weekend. Joe, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much indeed.
Sing the faith, sing the truth, burning fire in the belly.
Guatemalan singer and songwriter Gaby Moreno left her country for Los Angeles in 2001, where she quickly got into the local music scene and took classes at the Musicians Institute. Her soulful vocals and her ability to switch languages and genres have made her a rising star. Her songs have been used on popular television shows. She has 2 CDs out. Gaby Moreno is part of a batch of young, sweet, and soulful Latina singers who have an almost Fiona Apple or Tori Amos-like voice. But in her new album, Gaby channels her inner Aretha as well. That's what I'm gonna do. Hey, hey, hey. You should do. Hey, hey, hey. Gaby Moreno joins me from NPR West to talk about her new album. It's called Illustrated Songs, and it came out April 5th. Gaby Moreno, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me about that title, Illustrated Songs.
I am very inspired by old-fashioned music, and especially the music from the 1920s. And so I was looking for terms that were used in that era, in the vaudeville era. And I came upon this illustrated song term, which used to be an early visual art form that they did. They would project images with a live accompaniment, and I just thought it was a great idea to just project visuals and have the music be a part of it and tell a story. And I also felt like each song has its own story to tell, so I just thought the title was very fitting.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that you took a trip to New York City that really sort of started you down this path. Could you tell me about that?
Yes. My parents decided to take me to New York City on a vacation trip. And
how old were you then?
I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
And we had seen Les Miserables. And afterwards, we were just walking down Times Square. You know, it was maybe midnight, and there was so much going on, and for me, I had never experienced that before. And then I saw this lady who was singing on the streets, and I just froze. I mean, I can't even begin to describe you what I felt when I heard her music. And I asked her, what is that music? What is that style that you're singing? And she just looked at me like, you don't know what the blues is? And I asked my mom to take me to a record store right away and just buy blues records. And the first song on one of the compilations was Coco Taylor's Wang Dang Doodle.
Well, let's just play a little inspirational moment here so we can understand what comes after that. Till midnight, we're gonna fuss and fight till daylight. Are we gonna pitch a wing and doodle all night long? Now, Coco Taylor sounds a great deal rougher and tougher than you do on this album.
Yeah. Well, I have two sides of me, and I think people will be able to tell on this record. I do like the softer songs, but I can also belt some songs, and that's my other side, is just the soulful blues.
Now, when you were growing up in Guatemala, who were your other musical inspirations?
You know, once I discovered blues, that was it for me. I just decided this is the music that I'm going to listen to nonstop, and everybody around me was looking at me like, what is that music that you're listening to?
What was that music you're listening to?
Because everybody else, my friends, you know, they were listening to Latin pop music. And so it's almost like those singers, they became my teachers. I would just lock myself in my room and just sing Coco Taylor and Aretha Franklin. And I was also listening to Gladys Knight and Roberta Flack and Ella Fitzgerald.
Now, there are some tracks on the new CD that sound like, you know, like maybe music from the 20s or movie music, some of them from the 30s and 40s. Yeah. This track, which is called Daydream in Design, kind of stands out for me. We're going to listen to a second of it.
Bursting up above, a silhouetted dove, all the beauty rising, hiding any traces of the burden we left behind. Living in a daydream by design.
So where does this come from?
It's funny because I co-wrote this one with Larry Goldings and David Bateau, and I initially thought this sounds very Harry Nilsson, which I absolutely love. He's one of my favorite singers. But then the way Larry played it, you know, it was very jazzy, and it definitely has that 20s vibe to it. Fragile hearts
and porcelain. Now there's a song called Ave que emigra, which I guess is bird that migrates.
Yeah, it's it talks about my experience as a Guatemalan coming to the United States and, you know, leaving behind everything that I knew, leaving behind my family, my culture, and coming into this country. Vengo desde muy lejos, buscando el azul del cielo. Siguiendo
predicamentos, vengo desde muy lejos. So you're telling the story here, but it doesn't sound mournful. It doesn't sound like, this is not a song that's filled with loss, exactly.
No.
It's very lively.
It is, yeah. It's not a sad song. It's got a lot of positivity in it.
What does this say? Vengo desde muy lejos, I come from far away.
I come from far away, buscando el azul del cielo, looking for bluer skies.
So what we have heard so far, we've heard a kind of a 1920s style. We heard a little Aretha Franklin type music or Motown at the beginning.
Baby.
Slightly folky, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a survey course here. All kinds of musical styles.
That's right. But, you know, I think go on a journey. And for me, it's just, this is what makes me who I am. These are a mix of all my influences and what have made me. And I think the common denominator there is my voice.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Linda.
Singer-songwriter Gaby Moreno, her new album is called Illustrated Songs. It was released April 5th.
Tanto que hacer, hay tanto que hacer. Me siento bien, no hay tiempo que perder.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Phil Harrell and produced by Petra Mayer, Lauren Silverman, Brent Bachman, Lily Percy, and Jessica Deal. Daniel Shukin is our technical director. Our intern is Megan Kane. Muthoni Muturi was our editor. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Linda Wertheimer. We're back next Sunday with the best of weekends on All Things Considered. And remember, you can hear the full version of the program on your local public radio station each Saturday and Sunday afternoon.
So much to do, yes, so much to do. I'm willing and able, no time to lose. So much to see, you know there's so much to see. Beneath the carnival sky, oh, the jubilee. My heart dry up from now on, promise you.